case number 10-1322 et al., ICO Global Communications Holding Limited Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Clark, the petitioners, and Mr. Marcus for response.
Good morning. Jeff Clark here on behalf of all of the petitioners. In a word, what this case is about is the FCC's position that DBSD entered the band at a time before the band was cleared, when the applicable law provided that until the top 30 markets were cleared, there could be no band entry. And that is really the essence of the case, but let me take a step back and provide more context. In 2004, the FCC in the 800 megahertz order created a grand bargain that balanced the interests of all three of the parties in band clearing. Sprint is the band clearing entity, and Sprint accepted that risk. In paragraph 87, it's noted in the 800 megahertz order. The incumbents, secondly, in the BAS band, and then third, future new entrants like MSS operators such as DBSD. And the bargain that it struck essentially was that Sprint would be able to recoup reimbursement from later entrance to the band if it could demonstrate two things. So the liability that was created was conditional. The first was that there be band entry that actually had occurred, but in this case it's critical to understand that there could not be band entry during the time that the top 30 markets rule was in place, and that was in place until June 2009. And second, that band entry occur before the 36-month reconfiguration period ended, which was determined to be June 26, 2008. In this case, the FCC arbitrarily waived both of those conditions, effectively creating an unconditional liability for any party that later entered the band. And we think that that is unlawful, and the fact in particular that they did it retroactively, that in the September 2010 order, they provided that an act that had already occurred by DBSD, the certification of its satellite in May 2008, that was the event that triggered band entry, even though at that time, and for the next year and 1 month, the next 13 months, there could not be band entry because the top 30 markets rule had not been lifted. So we see that as both arbitrary and capricious for the agency not to have explained how it is that we could possibly have entered the band during a time when we were precluded legally under its own rules from entering the band. And we also think that it's unlawfully retroactive for imposing that band entry on us 2 years after we had already certified our satellite as operational and could not have possibly thought that that would trigger reimbursement liability.
So upon certification of operability, you had the potential to cause interference to the incumbents? I just want to be clear about that.
Yes, Your Honor. With all due respect, no, we did not have the potential to cause interference.
Precisely. So isn't that part of the FCC's point that it was applying the emergency technologies policies, and those, in terms of entering the band, focused on interference? And so until you were in that position, you knew from the beginning of this that you wouldn't have been considered to have entered the ban until you were in a position to cause interference.
Let me take a step back, because what's happening here is, let's say it was correct that you enter the band at the point that you cause interference,
Do you agree that's what the emerging technologies policy said?
We do not, but I'm answering your question on a hypothetical.
No, so, I want to be clear about that, though.
Okay, if that were correct, we don't think that we would have entered the band under that definition, because there was a separate rule that was legally precluding us from entering the band. So we didn't have the potential to do it because it was legally prohibited.
But
yes.
Your threshold point was that potential is not even the right standard.
That's right.
Until 2010.
Yes. And then on that question, our view is that a fair reading of the emerging technologies principles is that the main element was that you be essentially, ready to turn on commercial power. And not only could we not do that because of the top 30 markets rule, but also we weren't ready to do that and never did that. So we didn't enter the market even under the ban, even under the definition that we think is applicable.
Can you point to me where in the joint appendix you made that argument before the agency, that is, with respect to the definition of entering the ban?
Your Honor, we preserve these issues. We told the FCC.
That's why I'm asking you for the page.
Okay. I think, Your Honor, here are the pages I would refer you to. JA 27, note 11, JA 41.
Well, I'm going to look at them as we talk.
Okay.
I looked at them before and I couldn't find it, so. Now, the document we're looking at is
27.
Yeah. But what is that? What is that? That's a letter to
this. This is a letter.
Uh-huh.
And this document, we think, makes clear that we told the FCC that because of the top 30 markets rule, we couldn't enter the band.
I see. Okay. And what about the other argument? The argument that the definitions from the other technologies should apply and that should be the definition. Where is that?
We argued, Your Honor, that the applicable law should be applied. And it's our view that we don't need to restate for the FCC what its own applicable law is.
There appears to be disagreement about that. The FCC then in their order stated what they thought the rule was. You didn't ask to reconsider and argue what your view of the applicable law was, did you?
Your Honor, the reason for that is because it's by operation of the law of retroactivity. If the FCC in a rulemaking, and it doesn't have retroactive rulemaking authority, is going to define what the ban means on a prospective basis, that's one issue. But they can't use their rulemaking authority, which they don't have retroactive rulemaking authority, to tell you that you entered the ban when you were legally precluded from doing so and on a new set of
rules. I understand the legally precluded part, which I had not focused on before. But the other part, which is the definition of entering the band, they asked for submissions on the definition, and I don't see that you made one.
But the issue, Your Honor, goes to a rulemaking. It goes to the fact that if you can comment on what the rule in the future will be as to band entry. We had no obligation to comment on what the existing obligation was before the rulemaking was ever proposed or took place.
Well, if there was no clear definition before, and even in rulemaking, they're permitted to interpret their own order and give a definition. Now, I agree with you, if it was absolutely clear what the order, what the definition was before, they might have a retroactivity problem, but that would require you to tell them what you thought that was, or at least after they told you what they thought it was, to tell them they were wrong. And 405 seems to bar the argument to be considered by this court if you didn't make it before the agency.
Part of the response I'd like to give to that, Your Honor, is the fair notice doctrine, but let me give you two other arguments on the waiver point before I turn to that. One is that the FCC did actually consider this issue, and so under the Time Warner case, it is preserved.
But not under the Bartholdi case, which said that considering it, which came out almost exactly the same time, said that considering it alone isn't enough. But even so, I don't see the point where they considered it in the specifics that we're talking about.
Let me give you the next one, then. As Your Honor, I said there were two. And yeah. And that one is
actually
that
three, I guess.
I have some other ones other than that, but I was gonna focus on my top two. The next one is that TerraStar raised this argument. If you look at the June 12th RNO from 2009, you'll see in paragraph 73 that there's a reference there to TerraStar making the argument that it did not enter the ban before the cost-sharing obligation terminated and that a change would upset settled expectations. And let me drill down a little bit more on that.
Did TerraStar make the definitional argument or just that they hadn't yet entered the ban?
They made the argument that they hadn't entered the ban, and obviously, Your Honor, we think that clear within that is the idea that they didn't enter the ban based on the existing law in place at the time.
Well, with respect, if obviously that's the issue of whether you entered the band, and it's not enough to simply say we entered the band. You have to say why, so the agency can decide whether your reason is the reason is one that they agree with or disagree with.
Your Honor, the agency said in March of 2008, when it proposed lifting the top 30 markets rule, that the purpose of lifting the top 30 markets rule would be to allow parties to enter the band. So it was clear during the time, even in the FCC's own view, that the band had not been entered either by TerraStar or by DBSD, because that was the operative rule. And the FCC simply has no explanation for that, Your Honor. Let me turn to the issue of the sunset date as well, since we've been spending a lot of time talking about band entry. We also think that the FCC set the June 26, 2008 reconfiguration date, and that that was
in the reconsideration order. Fudge that a little bit. The 2005 order, if I have the date right.
Yes.
Yeah. The 2005 order. The 2004 order, I think, is, as you say, fairly crisp in saying it ends on June 26, 2008. Paragraph 113 of the 2005 order seems a little fuzzier. Can you respond to that? The FCC raises it.
Sure. We think that a close reading of that, Your Honor, shows that it actually supports our argument. Look at the first sentence. It says, we now address TMI and TerraStar's request to clarify that the MSS reimbursement obligation ends 36 months after the effective date of the 800 megahertz RNO. Now, that is not, it's very important to understand, the 36-month reconfiguration period during which Sprint would be doing band clearing. That's 36 months after this reconsideration order, when that becomes effective.
Okay, and so that would have pushed it to
a different date.
Past June 26, 2000.
Later in the same order in 2005, I think, is when it was clarified that the June 26 date was there. But this is asking for a different date. And then at the end of that sentence is particularly important because it says, and not the end of the 36-month 800 megahertz band reconfiguration process.
So that sentence, I agree, is good for you. What about the last sentence of that paragraph?
The last sentence of that paragraph says, we therefore deny TMI and TerraStar's request to tie reimbursement pro rata share of band clearing costs to Nextel's 30-month BAS relocation time frame. Mm-hmm. So that's not the 36-month reconfiguration period.
Right.
That's a different 30-month period, or to a time period that, again, ends 36 months after the 800 megahertz RNO.
And maintain the schedule previously established, which would be 36 months after the end date of the 36-month
reconfiguration
process.
Yes. So it can get confusing because these terms are similar, but we think this supports us, and actually that the FCC trying to use it against us is totally contrary to what the text of it says when you unpack it.
And that creates a vested right under the retroactivity doctrine.
Well, we would contend.
The first issue, I think you're arguing the branch of retroactivity that is imposing new penalties on past conduct on the enter the band issue. On this issue, suppose they hadn't changed the enter the band definition. Suppose they just extended the date a few years. Okay? So you would have to argue that it impaired a vested right. Right? And you're saying that is based on expectations, settled expectations, and reasonable reliance. A little fuzzy.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I would concede that, but I would say that
in Landsgraf, in a lot of cases, they throw out a bunch of different considerations.
Right.
Right. Keep going, though.
But let me say something about Landsgraf, because what the FCC says is that because we had independent obligations, essentially, on their band, entry theory to certify the satellite operational and so on, that means that in some level anything they could do to us would be fine, and we don't agree with that. In the Landgraf case, as the court will recall, there was a Title VII pre-existing obligation not to discriminate against people, and then along came Congress and it imposed new disabilities, new compensatory damage rights, and new punitive damage rights. So the fact that there was a pre-existing duty didn't prevent the court from saying that it was a retroactive new set of disabilities that were being imposed. And we think that's exactly what they're doing here. They created a conditional obligation. They told the parties these were the rules. We marched out. Everyone worked under them, and then, you know, years
that's
later.
Like changing enter the band, if I hear that creeping back in. Suppose my hypothetical, suppose they had kept the definition of entering the band the same, that it still required, in essence, commencing operations, okay? And all they do is extend the date out a few years.
If they extend the date out a few years and they give you prospective notice of that, Your Honor, then, you know, perhaps that's a different case than actually happened here.
If they did that before June 26th, 08, that would have been okay?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but
even though you might have made decisions premised on it ending on June 26th, though.
That's our principal position, is that we made decisions based on that. And Your Honor, you know, it can't escape notice that during this whole period, you know, we were under intense financial pressure, that we were excluded from actually using the satellite for commercial purposes, a very valuable asset lying fallow, and that there was upshot of this whole set of rules and the way the FCC unfolded them was that we went into bankruptcy.
Now suppose it ends on June 26th, 08, and then a year later, 2 years later, the FCC wants to create a new rule that says if you commence operations in this band, by entering the band, commence operations, you owe Sprint some amount of money for the relocation costs. So an entirely new rule.
We don't think, Your Honor, that the court could do that because, I mean, we don't think the FCC could do that because, you know, it might be able to do it for
the language of the order, I suppose, the original 04 order?
Yes, but we would also say, Your Honor, that if there were new band clearing costs, that they occurred on a prospective basis and they made us liable on a prospective basis for that, that would be a different situation than making us liable for band clearing costs that were already covered under the 2004 order that Sprint had already incurred. I see that I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for
Before you do, I wanted to talk about the corporate liability question?
Yes.
And maybe out of curiosity, isn't that the big question in the end? I mean, isn't the only one with the money the parent?
Well, it's a very important question, Your Honor, and we think that there's no warrant for the FCC having ignored the best foods rule there and reaching out after seeing the company enter bankruptcy to decide to go after its parent.
Right. So answer this question. If what do you think about the preclusive effect of the bankruptcy decision?
I think that turns on the issue of whether what they did was a rulemaking or an adjudication. By the FCC's own view of it, this was an adjudication. And because it's an adjudication, that if they're adjudicating as between Sprint and ICO, they're bound by the fact that the Sprint lost in the bankruptcy court in the Southern District of New York, and then on appeal to the Southern District of New York, didn't take an appeal to the Second Circuit. This is not a Brand X issue. If they want to establish different rules for different parties, that's fine. The point is that if they're acting in an adjudicatory mode, they have to respect the doctrine of collateral estoppel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Joel Marcus for the FCC. DBSD did not challenge the commission's definition of enter the band. And as Judge Garland has pointed out, it's now barred from doing so before this court. The commission did not have a fair opportunity to address any of the arguments that they're raising now.
What about the argument that MSS operators don't enter the band until the top 30 markets issue is resolved?
That's referring to an argument that was made before the commission prior to 2009, and I believe that's the case, then in the 2009 order, which we refer to as the 2009 BAS order, but it's also called a further notice of proposed rulemaking.
This is dated September 9th, 2008, the letter that he was talking about. So you say that's before the...
Right. The NPRM that set up the enter the band issue was issued on June 12th, 2009, and the commission specifically said, here's our proposed definition of enter the band, and we ask parties to comment on this specific proposed definition. And then, you know, a year later, the commission writes its order, the order that's now on review, and the commission specifically says, we received no comment on this issue. Even if...
Wait a second. The comments that are from JA 121 to 125 are all about how the new requirements, how there are new reimbursement obligations, new requirements, new reimbursement principles, new substantive standards, changing the reimbursement rules midstream, and how all that's impermissibly retroactive.
Well, I think it's interesting that that's not what Mr. Clark relied on as one of his top two when he was specifically pressed on this issue. But let me address that, Judge Kavanaugh.
He's not a stopped.
No, I'm not saying he is. But I'm saying that that may be a recognition of the weakness of the argument. And the reason why is because I think fairly read when DBSD in its comments is talking about cost-sharing requirements. It's talking about the June 26th date, and it's not talking about enter the band.
That would be a decent argument, except that would be insane to just argue about the date and not about the standard, because that would have given them zero relief.
Maybe that's true, but that's what they did. But also, Judge Kavanaugh...
It just doesn't make sense to read it that way. Right, I'm right on that, correct? That if
I think that it would have
if
been
the substantive
I
standards
think
stayed
a
the
major
same.
Oversight on their part, yes.
Well, let me get it right. Let me finish. Okay.
Yeah.
If the substantive standard stays the changes,
mm-hmm.
but the date stays the same
mm-hmm.
as the FCC wanted, so that what you think is their only argument prevails, right?
Correct.
They get zero help because the change in the substantive standard is what puts them on the hook.
They might get some help.
But minimum.
They're arguing that there's still a cutoff period and that many of Sprint's expenses took place after June 26th. So they could still have, they could have made the decision that, well, Sprint didn't really spend very much money before the cutoff, so we don't need to worry about the enter the band. It doesn't make a difference. It's immaterial. But let me also
Let me finish. Okay. When they refer to new reimbursement obligations, new requirements, new reimbursement principles,
yes.
That's not about the date.
It is about the date. And I think that
How is that about the date?
Well, they're using the term cost-sharing requirements.
No, they're using the phrase new reimbursement obligation, new reimbursement principles, what, new requirements.
Which page of the JA are you looking at, Judge
121, Kavanaugh? 122, 123, 124,
okay.
and 125.
Okay, so can I direct your attention to 123?
Yes.
And they say, this is in the first full paragraph, the last sentence, the proposed new requirements are retroactive in numerous respects, including but not limited to the June 26th issue. In other words, sure, they make a vague
allegation. How about the sentence
allegation.
Before that?
Right, but they make this vague allegation. It's retroactive. But then they specifically say, let me tell you why the June 26th issue is retroactive. And I think more critically, Judge Kavanaugh, if they had come in and they had filed a comment that said, your proposed definition of enter the band is retroactive, and I don't think that it's crisply focused enough, and the commission certainly didn't read this as a challenge to enter the band. But even if they had come in and said, your proposed definition of enter the band is retroactive, they're now relying on very specific arguments, a four-part test for something. They're saying
that's the commission's test.
It's not the commission's test. It's their argument about what the commission's test is.
Well, the emerging technologies principles.
Well, no, and yes, and that's a critical point, Judge Kavanaugh, and here's why. The emerging technologies principles, and I think if you read virtually every order in this proceeding, when the commission refers to the emerging technologies principle, it is referring to the principle that the people who come into the band second have to reimburse the people who come into the band first and
absolutely.
Paid for it.
I agree.
And that's the emerging technologies principle.
But before 2009, okay? Before 2009, is there anything where the FCC's ever said that entering the ban is just having an operational as opposed to commencing operations?
Well, keep in mind that there are different technologies involved in this than there had been in any other ban clearing.
My question's very specific.
Yes, and so I will point you to something that's not before you, but that it's in the 2000 MSS order. This was one of the early orders in this proceeding, and the citation of the page that I'm looking at is 15 FCC record at page 12375, and there the commission is setting a triggering rule for another aspect of this MSS entrant. There's a lot of bans involved here. We focused on a particular ban, but there was also some ban clearing requirements in other bans that are not before the court. And the commission in that rule said, subsequently entering licensees must reimburse the relocating licensees before the subsequently entering licensee may begin operations in these bans. In other words, it's that exact issue. You have to pay the money before you can start using it. And this is in 2000. And so
you think it's just been crystal clear the whole time?
I do not believe it's been crystal clear the whole time, Judge. I think it's been unclear for most of the time, Judge Kavanaugh. But I certainly don't think it's crystal clear in DBSD's favor, because the rules that they're relying on, which they never raised before the commission, and the commission never had a fair opportunity to address in this case, even if they had preserved a sort of general vague point of retroactivity, were rules that were implemented to effectuate the emerging technologies principle in specific services that had specific technologies related to them. In this band, there's no clearinghouse. There are no fixed microwave links. There's a whole set of issues that if you look at those rules, you can say those rules obviously don't apply to the MSS service context and to the complicated BAS context. And so, it's simply not reasonable for somebody to read the emerging technologies orders and even look at some of the rules that were implemented to effectuate the emerging technologies principle and come away with the idea that there was an ironclad rule here.
No one knew what made them liable to Sprint in the period before 2010?
Well, it's not that no one knew. Everybody knew that they would be liable to Sprint. Remember, the commission...
No one knew what activities would trigger liability.
No one knew exactly what activity would trigger liability. And it, really, at the time, it didn't make a difference under the commission's proposed schedule, because what was going to happen is there was going to be the BAS reorganization, there was going to be a launch of a satellite, and in the commission's typical experience, the satellites are put into commercial operation as soon as possible after their launch, and then a year later there was going to be the completion of the 800 megahertz reorganization. That's the 36 months. And so in the commission's contemplation of this schedule that was rather elaborately crafted, there was never really going to be an issue of exactly when you entered the band or exactly when you didn't enter the band. It was all going to happen in a series of planned steps. Now, it so happens that that schedule didn't take place as anybody expected. Part of it is that DBSD came in and said, we need a year extension on our satellite. Well, that blew the whole thing up. And then Sprint came in and said, this BAS thing is much more complicated than we thought. That blew it up. And then
I ask you another question on that.
May I just finish one point, Judge Kavanaugh?
Yeah.
Okay. And so it's highly noteworthy that at no point in any of those many orders juggling all of these pieces did the commission ever say, and this is going to let you off the hook. Rather, to the contrary, every single time, in every single order, the commission always said, and you're going to owe the money, you're going to owe the money, you're going to owe the money, because that's the emerging technologies principle. That's the thing that we've been trying to effectuate this whole time.
Did before 2009 the FCC ever say in any forum that the potential for interference was enough to trigger the obligation?
Well, again, in the fixed microwave context of those other rules, the interference and the potential for interference were one and the same. You would put your equipment in the ground and you'd turn it on, basically. And
That's not true in this context.
It turned out not to be true in this context, and it turned out not to be true in this context because it's taken so long between the launch of this satellite and the placement of it in operation. And that, by the way, is not because of the top 30 market rule. The top 30 market rule was lifted in mid-2009, and as of today, DBSD is not providing commercial service. In fact, it filed a status report with the FCC about a week ago saying we are still testing our satellite system.
As of June 2008, though, they couldn't commence operations. I take your point on that. They couldn't commence operations because of the top 30 market rule.
They couldn't commence commercial operations. That's correct. And they were warned about that. And keep in mind that the commission, at the time they were putting these obligations on Sprint to clear the band, they put an equal and actually prior obligation on DBSD to clear the BAS band. And at that time, the 30 market rule was in effect. And before Sprint even entered the picture, the arrangement was you pay the money, you pay it up front, you bear all the costs, and then once you've cleared the 30 markets, and only once you've cleared the 30 markets, may you begin commercial operation. So DBSD knew at every single step of this proceeding that it had the potential to be on the hook for payments, even if the top 30 markets weren't cleared. And
can I ask you, you made an argument in your brief that if we were to accept the definition of entering the market, or if it was entering the band, or if it was barred, that the deadline would be moot. Opposing counsel responded that if the deadline were 2008, they would only have expenses terminating on that day. Are they right about that?
I think that they are at least potentially right about that, and they're right enough about that. It's an interpretive question, but because their interpretation is a plausible one of the 800 megahertz order.
Money, is distributed, but I mean, does it make any, is most of the money spent, most of the costs incurred after that date?
I think at least a large amount of costs were incurred after that date. And so if the commission were to interpret that order in the way that DBSD suggests, then in fact, they would be right about that. So we are no longer relying on the mootness point because we think that their argument is potentially correct.
I'll have a chance to get back to this, but I do want to talk about the corporate liability issue. And the question is, why doesn't the decision in the bankruptcy proceeding bind you if, as opposing counsel pointed out, you're arguing that this is an adjudication? Why isn't that this an adjudication between Sprint and ICO? And in that case, why aren't you bound by the district by both the district court and the bankruptcy court's decision?
Well, I think that it's noteworthy that the petitioners here have not cited any case that actually stands for that proposition.
What proposition?
The proposition that that when the government is acting as an adjudicator and there's non-mutual parties that. Preclusion applies, and I think that if you my reading of the FLRA case that we cited in our brief, and this is at page 63 of our brief, and it's American Federation of Government Employees Council 835 F second 1458. I think my reading of that case was in fact that the FLRA was acting as an adjudicator there, and the case came here. There was a preclusion argument raised, and the court's resolution on the preclusion issue was you can't get estoppel against the government unless there's full mutuality of parties. And so the only thing that they're really relying on is the Deerfield case, Judge Garland. And Deerfield is very different from here because in Deerfield you had the government acting as an adjudicator, and it was the exact same two parties that were before
matter.
The commission.
Why?
It should matter. It should matter because in In the Deerfield context, and if you look at that opinion carefully, it's not really a res judicata case or, you know, a preclusion case at all. It's really a separation of powers case. And it's a different matter when an administrative agency in a coordinate branch of government undoes entirely the judgment of an Article III court and essentially renders it an advisory opinion with no practical effect. And I think it's different when a administrative agency doesn't give preclusive effect in a non-mutuality of situation,
because the
bankruptcy court's order will still, in fact, bind the people who were before that court, and that makes it totally unlike Deerfield. Sprint will not be able to seek any kind of joint and several liability among the various DBSD entities, but. Our action here does not undo that, and so that makes this completely unlike Deerfield and much more like what we believe to be the holding in the FLRA case.
What about on the changing the date issue, the fact that petitioners say that paragraph 261 of the 2004 order set a very precise end date, and therefore it was impermissible for the FCC to impair their vested rights by changing the date subsequently, retroactively?
The Commission read its prior orders, and it is entitled to essentially conclusive deference on that unless the reading is unreasonable. And the Commission, in fact, found DBSD's reading of the what we'll refer to as the 800 megahertz orders to be unreasonable. And I think the reason why is that the Commission was using, as the Commission found in this order, the Commission was using the term 36 months in that order, not as it's a hard and fast cutoff date, but rather as a descriptor. It wasn't prescriptive, it was descriptive. It was descriptive of the time that it would take to reorganize the band. And that's exactly why the Commission kept saying the true-up period. And even in paragraph 261 of the original order, Judge Kavanaugh, two sentences after the one that you have been looking at and discussing with Mr. Clark, Commission says, thus Nextel would no longer be entitled to reimbursement from other entrants to the band after receiving credit for its relocation costs at the true-up.
And I think the true-up is defined as being after the 36-month reconfiguration period.
Well, the true-up
is... The idea, I know your brief says this was just shorthand and this was just an expectation, and you just said something similar, but I think any rational, you said the standard's unreasonableness. I think anyone reasonably reading this would have thought, actually, this is a fixed date, and maybe the Commission screwed up by setting a fixed date back in paragraph 261. Now, I then asked... Mr. Clark about the...
Then you go to the recon
order. Let me finish. I asked Mr. Clark about the 2005 order, and that seems, although the language in there is confusing, and maybe you want to respond to him on this, that language also seems to reestablish that it's 36 months, that there's a firm 36-month period.
It does use the phrase 36 months, and again, I think it uses that phrase in that shorthand manner.
What does shorthand mean?
Shorthand means
it just means you're. It said 36 months, and now you don't want it to say 36 months.
Well, I think that,
and you're just rewriting the language, and I just don't see the wiggle room in there. And I find the efforts to pretend that it says something that it doesn't objectionable.
Well, I think if you look at the logic of the 800 megahertz true-up process and all, the point of the cutoff period was not to give the MSS people a benefit or to establish a particular date that had no relation to anything. The point of the cutoff period, and this was the very animating factor, and this is discussed explicitly in the recon order, was to make sure that Sprint didn't get paid twice. In other words, after the true-up happened, and they basically settled up with the government for the money, they didn't want them to be able to then go to the MSS people and say, and now you have to pay us, because that would effectively result in double payment. And the Commission was concerned that there not be double payment. And the Commission This is in paragraph 113 of the 2005 order. It says the commission decided to end the reimbursement obligations at the end of
What paragraph are you in?
113, Judge Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. And this is in the recon order.
Yes, I got it.
The 05 order. So this is the second sentence of the order. We decided to end the reimbursement obligation at the end of the 800 megahertz band true-up period for administrative efficiency in the accounting process. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, I don't think you can really fairly read the language of the two orders divorced from the point that the commission was trying to make here. There was a logic to these orders.
But it would have been
orders.
So easy to write. You've made very good policy arguments about what they should have said in 2004.
Well, I think that they said a lot of things, and they talked about both true-up periods and 36-month periods and all that stuff. And so I think the point is, given the policy argument and given what the commission was trying to accomplish, that you can't really walk away from this at the end of the day and say fairly that you could read all these things together, think about what the commission was doing, and say that there was an absolute hard and fast firm cutoff date.
Why did I?
Could I ask?
Do I
wish that they had done it more clearly?
Yeah,
yes.
Well, that's the point. The point is the people who wrote this and the commission understand how to put in a caveat, how to put in except if we change our mind, except if it doesn't work. There are lots of ways they could do this. They did not do this, and on both issues, the enter the band and the date. We have concerns as judges about retroactive changes in rules. That's a kind of fundamental to the rule of law. And it gets particularly troubling when there's retroactive changes in the rules and imposition of liability, and the agency doesn't just pretends it's all been crystal clear all along. I just don't see that.
You know, I think that the commission recognized that there were ambiguities in these orders, and so it's not pretending that it was crystal clear all along. I think that the commission resolved an ambiguity in a reasonable way based in the text of the orders that also fulfills the policy behind these orders, which the other reading of this decidedly would not do. And not only was there a policy having to do with the double compensation of Sprint, but then there was the larger policy issue of the animating principle behind this is the emerging technologies principle, and that is that the second people have to pay the first people, and that has pervades every aspect of this.
I think you have a great policy argument.
Let me just ask you if you're familiar enough with the record where comments were submitted that Sprint had assumed the risk that it could achieve the 800 megahertz relocation in 36 months, and if it didn't, then it would bear the cost.
Well, I think that
is the 2005 reconsideration order in response to those comments, or did those comments come later?
Well, I think that when the commission was talking about the specific risk that you're addressing, Judge Rogers, it was in the some of the early paragraphs of the 2004 order. The commission.
Well, I'm talking about comments that were submitted to the commission saying that, look, Sprint had assumed the risk that it could do this in 36 months. If it didn't achieve it, it bore all the costs it incurred.
These are comments that were submitted in 2004 that were submitted in this proceeding.
I didn't mark them in my notes, but I'll find them. I just wondered whether that was a way of reading the 2005 order as definitively rejecting that point of view.
I wish I could say I could confirm your suspicion, but I cannot do that, Judge Rogers. Right. And I think that the discussion in the 2005 order was expressly addressing some specific timing issues that were raised by some of the parties there. The commission did acknowledge that Sprint was bearing some risks in taking on the 36-month timeline, and one of those was that it could lose its licenses if it didn't do it on time, and one of them was that it could face forfeitures imposed by the commission. But, you know, there are probably eight or nine or even more orders that were issued in the course of this lengthy proceeding. And, you know, at no time in all of the schedule reconfigurations, in all of the moving parts that the commission had, in all of the times when DBSD came in and asked for extensions in its satellite launch date, at no time did the commission ever suggest that anything that it was doing would relieve the fundamental and basic obligation of repayment here. And I think that was an animating principle of this entire proceeding that is reiterated over and over again. I just don't think that even though there was some admitted ambiguities and imperfections in the orders and in the specific language that was used, I don't think that you can come away from this case at the end of the day and say that there's been any unfairness here. And
thanks to the amount of time we've had to discuss, I've been able to read the Flura case, and I don't really see how it's relevant to this preclusion argument. So Flura is the case where Flura, say even the FCC, argued a particular interpretation of its own statute before different circuits, lost in some circuits, but wasn't precluded from arguing in another circuit. That's not at all what, and the case is all about estoppel against the United States. This is a case where two private parties argued the case before federal court, where the federal court resolved the question, where the Supreme Court in Park Lane Hosiery says non-mutual defensive collateral estoppel is typical, not just, and now we're going to go on and consider offensive statute collateral estoppel.
Well, I think
I don't understand why. It's not that you're bound, it's that Sprint is bound.
Well, you know, I think that what's in the FLRA case, Judge Garland, FLRA was the adjudicator, and it had adjudicated some cases, and it lost in other
They were,
cases.
But it was
and
an
now
appeal,
it was,
but it was an appeal from administrative action. That's not what's going on here, and not in this case.
It was an appeal from an administrative adjudicatory action, and that's what is on appeal here. And that's how I read the case.
Yeah, but it's not the two private parties were not at issue in that case.
It was a government party and a
yes, but
a,
not
a
but
union.
That's not that it wasn't the same government party and it wasn't the same private party. They were both different in that case.
But I think that the opinion is not really discussing estoppel against the government litigant before the adjudicatory agency. I think that it was talking about estoppel against the adjudicatory agency itself.
Right. Now, Flura had adjudicated the question one way once in another and interpreted the statute one way in one circuit
and
was permitted to try it again in another circuit. That's just sort of non-acquiescence. That's not really has little to do with estoppel.
But it was acting as an adjudicator.
Well, it seems to me Sprint had every opportunity to appeal to the Second Circuit on this, and they didn't. So why aren't they left with wherever they were?
You know, ultimately, this is a case of DBSD versus the government, just the same way as it was in the FLRA case. And so they are asking that the court judicially estop the government from doing something here.
All right.
Anything further, Mr. Marcus, that you wanted to say?
Well, if the court doesn't have any further questions, we would ask that the court All affirm right. the commission's order. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Clark, do you want a minute or two?
Thank you, Your Honor. The FCC's position is that the emerging technologies principles essentially are only one principle, that if you enter the band at some future point, then you've benefited from Sprint's actions and you have to pay them. But that's not what they said when they established this obligation in the 800 megahertz order in 2004. Here's what they said. This is in the first sentence of paragraph 261. We have decided to generally follow the cost-sharing principles that licensees that ultimately benefit from the spectrum cleared by the first entrant shall bear the cost of reimbursing the first entrant for the accrual of that benefit, except as discussed below. And then what follows are setting forth the exceptions, and the two exceptions are that you have entered the band and that you have entered the band before the relevant 36-month reconfiguration period ends. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to say that the exception they established for this particular MSS reimbursement obligation to Sprint, that those exceptions are no more. They've waived them after the fact, and we just think that that is contrary to fundamental principles of the rule of law, as we're referred to. On the issue of the
let me go to the last issue, the issue of enterprise liability. We think that just as Judge Garland was reading it, that's the Mendoza principle of, you know, collateral estoppel against the government. It's totally different if you're talking about litigating between two parties. You're not talking about something controlled by the non-acquiescence doctrine that agencies can essentially fight in multiple circuits until the Supreme Court actually resolves an issue. That's not what's at stake. This was just a pure litigation, and there was no reason, if you're acting in a quasi-adjudicatory mode like the FCC was here, for them not to act like ordinary adjudicators and give the respect to the Southern District of New York decision that they should have given.
Can I go back to the question of the definition of entering the band?
Sure.
I take the point that Judge Kavanaugh was addressing in discussion with opposing counsel, that you must have been arguing that you had already entered the band, otherwise this couldn't be retroactive. But was the definition of what entering the band was so clear that you didn't have to tell the FCC what it was, so that they would know if they were going to disagree with that, what the arguments were, so they could respond to them?
Your Honor, two responses. That's why we established this kind of as a sila in charybdis for the FCC. Either it was not clear, in which case it was a black box. They say time and again, I counted at least 5 pages in their brief, where they say that band entry was never defined. So if that's right, then $100+ million liability for DBSD hinges on something that was never defined before. That has to be a violation of the fair notice doctrine. Alternatively, you can hold them to what they said. And what they said was that this would be governed by the emerging technologies principles. And I just read to you from that paragraph 261 that says it would be this principle of basic reimbursement, as you know, with some exceptions. Here are the exceptions, and those exceptions weren't met here. There was not band entry, and there was not band entry before the reconfiguration period ended. So whatever path you take, we think that they're barred. And then the last point is, because they're acting in it.
I'm not sure about I understand the fair notice argument. If you thought it was too vague, you didn't have to launch your satellite. I mean, if you, or you could have asked for clarification or any of a number of other things. They didn't, you weren't required to go into this market. So I don't understand why there's a fair notice problem, assuming that it's vague.
We think that it was clear, Your Honor. That's
well,
our principle.
We don't really rely on the fair notice argument.
We rely on it in the alternative because we did not know until they filed their brief and then took the position in their order that band entry, you know, had never been defined in any way before. And so as a response to that position, we think that even if that were true, even if it were never defined before, that it would be unlawful to hold parties for such an obligation liable if they couldn't have known what it was until September 2010.
Mr. Marcus cited something in responding to your point that it was clear before. He cited something from 2000 that's not in his brief about FCC 12375.
Yes. Yeah, so my response to
don't
that.
Don't look to that, but do you have a response to that?
To the particular text of it, I didn't have it, unfortunately, with me today, but my response to that was intended to be that's something from 2000 when the general emerging technologies principles were established. But when they came to MSS specifically, which is what we're dealing with, they said we're going to apply the emerging technologies principles with these exceptions. And what we're relying on is the fact that the exceptions were not met. And that's what the FCC wants to erase. They want to throw out the window the fact that they made some exceptions. And then later on, you know, they think it's improvident that they made those exceptions. And it's retroactive, Your Honor, because they say that they're clarifying. They use that word. But what they really keep saying is there were changed circumstances. That means that something happened in the future that caused them to regret what they did in the past. It means that they're not clarifying something that happened in the past. It means that they're making a new rule based on 2020 hindsight.
All right, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you.